Norman Finkelstein is an author and scholar on contemporary Palestine. He spoke last week to an overflow audience of 800 people on the UBC campus. His main focus was the reasons Israel initiated its massacre of Palestinians in Gaza. The meeting was organized by the UBC student group Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights. The complete talk and the question and answer period were videotaped by Working TV and can be seen on their website, workingtv.ca. This morning, our first hour consists of excerpts from that lecture. We're going to begin where Norman Finkelstein posed the following question.
What were the main reasons for Israel's attack on Gaza? In my opinion, there were basically two reasons for the attack. First of all, to restore what Israel calls its deterrence capacity, a technical term basically meaning restoring the Arab world's fear of Israel. That was its first goal. And secondly, to turn back the Palestinian peace offensive that had been launched by Hamas the past couple of years. Let me look at those goals or aims of the Israeli attack in order. The main New York Times correspondent in the occupied territories and in Israel, a fellow named Ethan Browner, he wrote that Israel's larger concern in the war, using his words, was to reestablish Israeli deterrence because Israel's enemies are less afraid of it than they once were or than they should be. And this notion of preserving your or Israel's deterrence capacity has always loomed very large in Israeli military doctrine. So let's take the case of how the whole saga of Israel and Gaza began, namely the June 1967 war. It was the climax of that war when Israel occupied the West Bank, Gaza, and assorted other territories, which won't concern us this evening. Now, it's often said that Israel went to war in June 1967 because of the blockade that the Egyptian President Nasser imposed on the Straits of Tehran and because Israel's survival was at stake. But neither of those claims are factually true. It is correct that Mr. Nasser, or President Nasser, imposed a blockade on the Straits of Tehran after Israel laid plans and boasted about its aim to attack Syria. But the blockade that Nasser imposed was actually not very significant. Israel had very little trade going through the Straits of Tehran. And in fact, and what's little known, after a few days, Nasser was letting boats pass through the straits. In fact, there was no blockade of the Straits of Tehran. Israel also claimed, apart from the blockade, which, as I said, actually didn't exist, there was the threat to Israel's survival. But there's no evidence that the Israeli leaders ever felt a threat from Nasser or the neighboring Arab states. How do we know this? Well, there's a fairly extensive documentary record on the topic. Beginning in May 1967, all the U.S. intelligence agencies were testing the prospects and possibilities of an attack by Egypt on Israel. And they kept using the information that was provided by Israel. And each time, the intelligence agencies kept coming back with the same conclusions. Number one, that Egypt was not going to attack. And number two, if Egypt did attack, then Israel, and now I'm quoting Lyndon Baines Johnson, the president at the time, he said, according to all of our intelligence, If Egypt were to attack in collusion with all the other Arab states, according to our intelligence, said President Johnson, you would, and now I'm quoting him, allow me one second, you would whip the hell out of them. That was the conclusion of the U.S. intelligence agencies. Well, what did the Israelis believe? It happened that the head of Israeli intelligence was in Washington at the time, and he said to the Americans, and now I'm quoting him, he said that there are no differences between the U.S. and the Israelis on the military intelligence picture or its interpretation. That is to say, in June 1967, Israel agreed with the United States. Nasser was not going to attack, and if he did, and even if he did with neighboring Arab states, the Israelis would whip the hell out of them. Well, then why did Israel launch its first strike in June 1967? The reason is fairly straightforward. Nasser was this radical nationalist, and he was defying Israel. And he made all of these defiant gestures in June or in May 1967. So he had to be cut down to size. He had to be reminded who is in charge in the Middle East. At that time, Ariel Sharon was a divisional commander, and he said, we have to attack. Why? Because Nasser is getting out of hand. We are losing our deterrence capacity, our main weapon, the fear of us. The Arabs were not afraid of us. And so we have to cut them down to size. One of the leading Israeli historians in the topic, a fellow named Ze'ev Ma'oz, he said the reason Israel attacked in June 1967 was to restore the credibility of Israeli deterrence, to restore the deterrence capacity, to restore the Arab world's fear of Israel, to remind the Arab world who is in charge. Israel is in charge. That was 1967, when the problem begins with the occupied territories. And now if we move up to the year 2000, Israel faces another threat to its deterrence capacity. Those Arabs are getting out of hand again. They're getting too uppity. So in May 2000, after an 18-year-long guerrilla war, the Hezbollah expels Israel's occupying army from South Lebanon. Israel suffers a humiliating defeat, and it's a defeat which is celebrated throughout the Arab world. Immediately after suffering its defeat, in May 2000, Israel begins preparing for another war against the Hezbollah. They have to restore their deterrence capacity. They have to restore the Arab world's fear of Israel. In summer 2006, Israel finds its pretext and it unleashes the fury of its air force and prepares a ground invasion against the Hezbollah. But alas, it suffers yet another ignominious defeat. In fact, it was a defeat of colossal dimensions. A respected American military analyst, partial to Israel, But nonetheless, he concludes, and now I'm quoting him, "The Israeli Air Force, the arm of the Israeli military that had once destroyed whole air forces in a few days," referring to the June 67 war, "not only proved unable to stop Hezbollah rocket strikes, but even to do enough damage to prevent Hezbollah's rapid recovery. Once Israel's ground troops crossed into Lebanon, they failed to overtake Hezbollah's strongholds, even those close to the border." If you look at some basic figures, you get a sense of how big the defeat was that Israel suffered. Israel deployed 30,000 troops in Lebanon on the eve of the war. The total number of Hezbollah fighters and irregular Hezbollah forces totaled 6,000. Israel delivered and fired 162,000 weapons against Lebanon. Hezbollah fired 5,000 weapons. The number of weapons Hezbollah fired for the whole duration of the war, Israel fired each day of the war for 34 days. And in fact, Israel never even fought the main Hezbollah army. The crack Hezbollah troops were stationed along the Litani River, waiting for the Israeli invasion that never happened. Israelis were very upset by the defeat they suffered in 2006, and they were itching for another war against the Hezbollah. From their point of view, they were not down. They were down, but they were not yet out. They wanted another crack at the Hezbollah. But they didn't yet have a military option. In mid-2008, they desperately sought to conscript the United States for an attack on Iran. They hoped by knocking out Iran, they would also decapitate Hezbollah and then defeat their main challengers in the region. Israel threatened that it was going to use non-conventional weapons, nuclear weapons, if the United States didn't join in the attack on Iran. Well, to Israel's chagrin and humiliation, the United States opted out, Iran went its merry way, and Israel's deterrence capacity, its capacity to terrorize the Arab world into submission, it slipped another notch. It was high time to find a defenseless target to annihilate. Enter Gaza, Israel's favorite shooting gallery. Even there, the feebly armed Islamic movement, Hamas, had defiantly resisted Israeli dictate in June 2008, even compelling Israel to agree to a ceasefire. Well, what was the strategy? What were they going to do in Gaza? It was pretty straightforward. During the 2006 Lebanon War, Israel flattened this area of South Beirut known as the Dahiya. It was a Hezbollah stronghold, a large amount of popular support among the poor in Beirut. I had a chance to visit that area a few months ago. They turned it into a moonscape, where once there were 5- and 6-story apartment dwellings, there was just nothing. And Israel then began to talk about the Dahiya strategy. What was the Dahiya strategy? They said, we shall pulverize the 160,000 Shiite villages in Lebanon that have turned into Shiite army bases. We shall not show mercy when it comes to hitting the national infrastructure of a state that in practice is controlled by Hezbollah. That was the head of the Israeli Army Northern Command. A reserve colonel said, should there be hostilities, we have to act immediately, decisively, and with force that is disproportionate. Such a response aims at inflicting damage and meting out punishment to an extent that will demand long and expensive reconstruction. The Interior Minister said in September 2008, if the Palestinians fire a rocket, the IDF should decide on a neighborhood in Gaza and level it. That's the Dahiya strategy. The operative plan for the Gaza bloodbath can be seen by looking at the authoritative statements released by Israeli officials as the massacre got underway. A reserve major general said, what we have to do is act systematically with the aim of punishing all the organizations that are firing the rockets and mortars, comma, as well as the civilians who are enabling them to fire and hide. The IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces official spokesman said, is a legitimate target. And it was a real success. We can't dispute that. Whereas Israel killed a mere 55 Lebanese during the first 2 days of the Lebanon War in 2006, the Israeli media exulted at Israel's what they called shock and awe as it killed more than 300 Palestinians in the first 2 days of the attack on Gaza. Was it an accident? Several days into the slaughter, an informed Israeli strategic analyst wrote, the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, which planned to attack buildings and sites populated by hundreds of people, did not warn them in advance to leave, but intended to kill a great many of them, and succeeded. The historian, the sometime historian Benny Morris, the full-time propagandist Benny Morris, he could barely contain his pride at what he called Israel's highly efficient air assault on Hamas. Not everyone in Israel was so impressed. The Israeli columnist B. Michael, he was not very impressed by what he called the dispatch of helicopter gunships and jet planes over a giant prison and firing at its people. Who are these people they were firing at? Gideon Levy says, you may recall those police cadets who were killed on the first and second day, or first or second day. Who were they? Gideon Levy describes them, 70 traffic cops at their graduation ceremony, young men in desperate search of a livelihood who thought they'd found it in the police and instead found death from the skies. As Israel targeted schools, mosques, hospitals, ambulances, UN sanctuaries, as it flattened entire neighborhoods, as it slaughtered and incinerated Gaza's defenseless civilian population, Israeli commentators gloated that, quote, Gaza is to Lebanon as the second sitting for an exam is to the first. A second chance to get it right. And this time, Israel had hurled back Gaza not 20 years, as it promised to do in Lebanon, but into the 1940s. Electricity is available only for a few hours a day. He's so happy. Another commentator, Israel has regained its deterrence capabilities because the war in Gaza has compensated for the shortcomings of the 2006 Lebanon War.
We're listening to Middle East scholar and author Dr. Norman Finkelstein. He was speaking at UBC on January 28th to an overflowed crowd of some 800 people. Having explained what he sees as the first main reason for Israel's decision to slaughter Palestinians in Gaza, Norman Finkelstein proceeded to the second main reason, and that's where we rejoin his talk.
The other main goal of the Gaza slaughter was to fend off, to defeat the threat posed by Palestinian moderation. For the past three decades, the entire international community has agreed on how to resolve the Israel-Palestine conflict. And virtually everybody in this room, I suspect, knows the capsule formula for resolving it. It's called the two-state settlement based on the full Israeli withdrawal from the territories it occupied in June 1967 and a just resolution of the refugee question based on the right of return and compensation. Every year, the vote is the same in the United Nations. This past year, they put forth those terms for resolving the conflict, two states on the June 67 border, resolving the refugee question based on the right of return and compensation. The vote this past year, 2008, it was 164 in favor, 7 against. The whole world on one side, Israel, the United States, Australia, the Marshall Islands, Micronesia, Nauru, and Palau on the other side. You go back to 1989, about 20 years ago. There's a vote on the two-state settlement on the June 67 border in the United Nations General Assembly. The vote 151-3. The whole world on one side, Israel, the United States, and the island state of Dominica on the other side. You can go through the record, very easy to find. Just go and Google peaceful settlement of the question of Palestine, and you'll see the record for the past two decades. The whole world on one side, Israel, backed by the United States, and a few South Sea islands on the other side. The Arab League, in March 2002, it put forth a settlement, two states, June 67 border, just resolution of the refugee question. All 22 members of the Arab League approve it. And the Arab League keeps renewing the offer to Israel. You have the whole world as represented in the General Assembly. You now have the main regional organization, the Arab World, putting forth this settlement. Well, things are looking very dire for Israel. They're bordering on a disaster. And now the disaster is full-blown because Hamas signals it too supports a two-state settlement on the June 67 border. I can quote 100 statements just for convenience's sake. I'll quote a recent one from the Hamas head of the Hamas's political bureau, Khaled Meshel, and he said in March 2008, and I'm quoting him, "There is an opportunity to deal with this conflict in a manner different than Israel, and behind it, the U.S. is dealing with it today. There is an opportunity to achieve a Palestinian national consensus on a political program based on the 1967 borders. And this is an exceptional circumstance in which most Palestinian forces, including Hamas, accept a state on the 1967 borders. There is also an Arab consensus on this demand. This is a historic situation. But, says the leader of Hamas, no one is taking advantage of this opportunity. No one is moving to cooperate with this opportunity. Even this minimum that has been accepted by the Palestinians and the Arabs has been rejected by Israel and by the U.S. So, now we have a full-blown catastrophe. Hamas, too, accepts the two-state settlement. And what's worse, Hamas enters into a ceasefire with Israel in June 2008. And according to Israel's official publication, and now I'm quoting it, this is after the massacre began. Israel's official website, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, posted a publication entitled The 6-Month Lull Arrangement. And now I'm quoting what Israel's official Ministry of Foreign Affairs publication says. Hamas was careful to maintain the ceasefire it entered into with Israel in June 2008. It was careful to maintain the ceasefire, despite the fact that Israel reneged on its responsibility, namely easing the blockade around Gaza. The publication continues, the lull, the ceasefire, was sporadically violated by rocket and mortar shell carried out by rogue terrorist organizations. At the same time, Hamas tried to enforce the terms of the arrangement on the other terrorist organizations, and Hamas tried to prevent them from violating it. So now we have a new disaster. Hamas is abiding by the ceasefire. Well, it gets worse. According to the head of the Shin Bet, Israel's internal security organization, agency, Hamas was interested in renewing the ceasefire. Well, now we have a catastrophic development or sequence of developments. Because Israel could no longer justify shunning Hamas. And it would only be a matter of time before international pressure, especially from the Europeans, would be exerted on Israel to negotiate with Hamas. Interestingly, this is not the first time Israel faced such a diabolical threat. An Arab League peace initiative, Palestinian support for a two-state settlement, and a Palestinian ceasefire. And it's not the first time that Israel embarked on provocation and war to overcome this diabolical threat. In the mid-1970s, well before most of you were born, the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, which was headed by a fellow named Yasser Arafat, they came out in support of a two-state settlement. In addition, the PLO, it was headquartered in Lebanon at the time. In June 1981, the PLO entered into, lo and behold, a ceasefire with Israel. So now we have the PLO supporting the two-state settlement, and we have a ceasefire. And then another catastrophe unfolds back then. In 1981, August to be precise, the Saudis put forth a peace plan. And then the Arab League endorses the peace plan. Exactly what happened in the build-up to the current massacre. How did Israel react? The PLO has agreed to a two-state settlement. The PLO agrees to a ceasefire. The PLO strictly adheres to the ceasefire. The Arab League puts forth a peace plan. It was called back then the Fahd Peace Plan, F-A-H-D, named after, I guess it was King Fahd at the time. How does Israel react? In September 1981, 1 month after the Arab League presents its peace plan, 2 months after the PLO enters into the ceasefire, Israel prepares to destroy the PLO. Why? Let me quote to you from Israel's, he's since passed away, leading strategic analyst, and now a fellow named Avner Yaniv. He says as follows. Yasser Arafat was contemplating a historic compromise with Israel. But all the Israeli leaders and the main opposition in Israel opposed a full Israeli withdrawal from the West Bank. So what did Israel do? It conducted punitive military raids, listen carefully because it'll sound familiar, deliberately out of proportion against Palestinian and Lebanese civilians. Why did it do that? To weaken PLO moderates, strengthen the hand of radical rivals, and to make sure the PLO is inflexible, that it won't support a two-state settlement. But Yasser Arafat, that demonic, diabolical terrorist, he wouldn't budge. He kept to his word on the ceasefire, and he kept saying he wants a two-state settlement. So Israel only had two choices, says Mr. Yaniv. A political move leading to a historic compromise with the PLO, or preemptive military action against it. Well, what does it do? I like this phrase. Mr. Yaniv says, to prevent Arafat's peace offensive, Israel decided to attack. He says the Israeli invasion had been, quote, preceded by more than a year of effective ceasefire. But then Israel began its murderous provocations, the last of which left as many as 200 civilians dead. That was in May 1982. 60 occupants of a children's hospital were killed. And finally, the PLO retaliated, fired some shells into northern Galilee, and killed one civilian. Now, Israel claimed it was these rocket attacks from Lebanon into the Galilee that caused them to attack Lebanon. But what does Yaniv say? He says the raison d'etre of the entire operation was destroying the PLO as a political force capable of claiming a Palestinian state on the West Bank. It had nothing to do with the shelling of the Northern Galilee, and it had everything to do with the fact that the PLO was too moderate, and Israel did not want to leave the West Bank. Well, fast forward to 2008. In December 2008, Israeli Foreign Minister Tzipi Livni, she says Israel wants a temporary ceasefire, a temporary period of calm with Hamas, but not an extended truce, because an extended truce harms the Israeli strategic goal, empowers Hamas, and gives the impression that Israel recognizes the movement. Translation: a protracted ceasefire that enhanced Hamas's credibility would have undermined Israel's strategic goal of retaining control of the West Bank. So, as far back as March 2007, Israel decides to attack Hamas. It negotiates a truce in June 2008. Why? The Israeli press is very candid. It said Barak, the defense minister, needed time to prepare an attack. Once all the pieces were in place, Israel only lacked a pretext. And on 4 November, while the American media were riveted on Election Day in the United States, Israel broke the ceasefire by killing 7 Hamas militants on the flimsy excuse that they were digging a tunnel to abduct Israeli soldiers, an excuse that nobody in Israel took seriously. After Hamas predictably resumed its rocket attacks in retaliation. Whose phrase is that? It's the same document on the Ministry of Foreign Affairs website, the Israeli Intelligence and Terrorism Information Center. They say it was Israel that broke the ceasefire and Hamas reacted in retaliation. Israel could now embark on yet another murderous attack in order to foil yet another Palestinian peace offensive. That's the basic picture.
You're listening to a lecture by Middle East scholar and author Dr. Norman Finkelstein. He spoke at UBC January 28th. We're going to rejoin that lecture in a moment. You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM. We are a member-owned station. If you want to know more about Co-op Radio, we'll send you out a free listener's guide with a full schedule of our programming. You can call us now at 684-7561. We're going to return now to the concluding excerpt from Dr. Finkelstein's lecture. Here he comments on the arguments of supporters of Israeli actions in Gaza. Norman Finkelstein begins with comments on Michael Ignatieff, whom he refers to as the carpetbagger from Harvard.
He says, Israel has the right to defend itself. Hamas is a terrorist organization. Israel kills 1,200 Palestinians, targets ambulances, mosques, schools, hospitals, drops white phosphorus indiscriminately in civilian neighborhoods. But Hamas is a terrorist organization. Israel has the right to defend itself. But Palestinians have no right to defend themselves. Palestinians don't even have the right to live. I know some of you are not aware of that because you haven't read the Geneva Conventions, but it's there. You have to search hard, but it's there. Everybody in the world has the right to live, but the people of Palestine do not have that right. Israel has the right, with the support of the United States and the European Union, to put a brutal blockade on Gaza. Before the ceasefire was over, Mary Robinson, the High Commissioner, the former High Commissioner for Human Rights, she went to Gaza. She says, "I can't believe what I see before my eyes. An entire civilization is being destroyed." But Gaza, the people of Gaza, they have a moral responsibility, a legal responsibility to commit collective suicide. They have no right to resist, no right to defend themselves. Only Israel has a right to defend itself. Israel is building a wall which is robbing the Palestinians of 12% of the West Bank. The entire international community, apart from the U.S. and Israel, have declared the wall illegal. The International Court of Justice, the highest judicial body in the world, declared that wall illegal. But Palestinians have no right to defend themselves when 10% of the 22% of their homeland that's left is being stolen before everyone's eyes and despite the ruling of the highest judicial body in the world. Only Israel has the right to defend itself. Bernie Farber, the head of the Canadian Jewish Congress, he issued a statement. He's appalled. He's shocked. He's filled with repugnance, disgust, because he saw a demonstration and an Israeli flag was being burned. But 400 Palestinian children incinerated. That doesn't concern him. Only an Israeli flag being burned in a demonstration. Then come along these human rights organizations, like Amnesty and Human Rights Watch. And they babble and babble and babble some more about whether or not Israel's response was disproportionate. There's a massacre occurring before our eyes, and they can't figure out whether or not it's proportionate. It's as if a Sherman tank were to crash into a playground, blowtorch the children in the playground, and Amnesty and Human Rights Watch are pondering, was that proportionate? I say, what right does Israel have to use any force against the Palestinians? If it doesn't want rockets coming its way, there's a simple solution. Join the rest of humanity. Join. Join the 164 nations in the United Nations General Assembly. Join the International Court of Justice. Join the Arab League. Join the Palestinian Authority, so-called authority, and the Hamas, and withdraw from the territories which you are illegally occupying. Then come the Europeans, the British, the French, the Germans, and they all go to Gaza, and they all meet with Mubarak, and they meet with Olmert. And why are they meeting with them? We have to figure out ways to prevent weapons from being smuggled to Hamas. Now, you have to savor that. You really do. Israel has now just committed a massacre in Gaza. Israel has incinerated the people of Gaza. Israel has committed massive war crimes in Gaza. So what do we have to do? We have to prevent Hamas and the Palestinians from having weapons. Israel commits the massacre, so what do? We have to disarm Hamas. Why? Do Palestinians have to be completely disarmed? Were they not satisfied with the killing ratio of 100-1? Should the ratio be 1,000-1? Is that why they want the Palestinians to be completely disarmed?
You've been listening to Middle East scholar and author Dr. Norman Finkelstein. The foregoing were major excerpts from a talk that he gave January 28th at UBC. Dr. Finkelstein concluded his lecture expressing the view that the most formidable weapons available to opponents of Israeli policy are truth and justice. He expressed his sincere confidence that with these, Israel will be defeated. And we want to thank Working TV for recording and posting the full lecture on their website and for allowing Red Eye to download it for rebroadcast. Working TV's website is workingtv.com. And now we're going to listen to Joni Mitchell, and this is from the album Blue. This track is River.
Anything affiliated with Hamas